of the Wave Band, and I'm going to be talking about the deepest ever campaign to date in the X-ray on the galactic sensor using Chandra, with quite a bit of multi-wavelength coverage as well. Now, it's kind of interesting, you know, about this whole campaign took place over 2012, and basically it started 2 weeks after the last EHT meeting. So I actually went back and looked at my slides from that, and it's amazing how much we've learned in the meantime. So that's kind of the way I've structured the talk, is I'm going to tell you a little bit about what we knew at that meeting a few years ago, and then what we know now from this. And I just want to mention there was a big chunk of the Galactic Center community was arrayed behind this campaign. A lot of people are in this room. But I just list sort of the main authors of the papers that I'm going to show some figures from. And I'm highlighting some of the younger members of my group who are here and also presenting posters. So I'll bring that up later. Okay, so I think the point is, right, we're all in this room because we're happily, eagerly waiting for some images of the inner Schwarzschild radii, few Schwarzschild radii of our galactic center, in M87 or so, which is great. But there's this issue that in order to interpret those images, basically what we need to do is build some kind of model, and then we have to maybe do some add-on physics to make a fake image of some kind and then try to analyze if this looks like what we expect. And so there's a lot of questions involved in doing this. I mean, these are questions that you've heard so far from Marta, from John, about black holes in general that we need to address. But if we're not going to understand this if we're going to understand this for any black hole, it's really going to be Sagittarius A star, because we can see it from the outside in. It's the only black hole, even more so than M87, that we can do that with. And so there's questions about, you know, the outer boundary conditions, what's initiating the fueling, what's the accretion rate, how much gas is actually captured, and then how it starts to move in, into what kind of geometry of inflow, and then do we have outflows? As I'll tell you later, we definitely know we have some kind of winds, but there's this big magic question of whether we have real jets. And then when you look in simulations, you produce these jets, but do these jets actually look like reality? Because at the moment, we're not so sure which part of the jet is the emitting part. And so to go from, for instance, simulations to observations, and you'll be hearing, I think, quite a bit about that in this meeting, there's a lot of discussion at the microphysics level that isn't tracked in the simulations, or at least it's just starting to be tracked, about the densities, the ratios between the temperatures, whether you have thermal or non-thermal particles, and different types of things like particle acceleration. A lot of this stuff is added on as a layer, so you have this dynamic layer, and then you have this microphysics layer, and there's a lot of inputs that we're just not so sure of at the moment. So Sagittarius star, and I mean, not even mentioning the shape of space-time, which I'm going to black out now because I'm not going to say anything about that. But so we were trying to go after this to some extent with the Chandra observations. We thought that we could make a lot of progress on these particular issues. So going back to the EHT meeting in 2012 in Tucson, these were a couple of the slides that I showed, and this is what we knew. Was that the galactic center, as seen by Chandra, this is about the inner one arc minute or so, you know, looks pretty scruffy. We kind of saw some sources, and we already knew at this point, this is the PSF of Chandra, as seen from some background point sources, that Sagittarius star was an extended source. So basically, we're seeing something extended coinciding with the galactic center, but the question is, what exactly was this extended emission? And if you look at the best size of the source is a little bit less than an arc minute, this corresponds to roughly what you would expect to be the Bondi radius or the influence of the black hole in the galactic center. And so a lot of people have this idea, many in this room, that we're looking at thermal emission, like Brunschelung, from that gas that's captured at the outer radii. The issue is that around this time with Chandra as well, there started to be other possibilities that this gas could be. And for instance, there had been known from other instruments at lower resolution that there was this 8 kV plasma permeating the galactic center. And it turned out that at the time of this talk, you could actually resolve this into to 80% level, resolve it into individual sources. So some people started saying, hey, you know we have a lot of stars in the galactic center. Maybe these are just coronally spun up main sequence stars that are radiating X-rays, and we're just going to resolve this emission. That was an idea put forward by Sazonov in 2011, but the paper came out the next year. And the core prediction of this would be that you would have iron fluorescent line at 6.4 keV. So we had pretty ratty spectra because we've been using the ACES chip, which doesn't have good spectral resolution. So we knew there was an iron complex, but you know, whether that was 6.4, 6.7, or even 7 keV, and that's a really big difference in terms of the plasma diagnostics, we weren't really sure. The other thing we knew was that Sagittar had flares. So about once a day, Sagittar flares in the X-ray. Sometimes, usually a factor of a few, but sometimes we saw a flare that even went up to about 100. And so the idea was to try to go after these flares because we only had 20 at the time. And so they were interesting. But in order to do the kinds of statistical analysis you might want to do or detailed modeling, you would actually need higher statistics and more of these. And so, for instance, you know, we could maybe do some sort of spotty distribution and say that it could be a power law of flares, but it was very, very ratty. So that was then, and so a bunch of us got together. Fred Baganoff, Mike Novak, and I were the PIs, but then we assembled a very large group because there was a new program with Chandra called the X-ray Visionary Project that year, where they were letting people apply for a really huge amount of time in order to go after these sort of legacy projects. And so you can see a lot of people were involved, and Jeff and Charles were here, and Andrea Goldberg were part of the scientific steering committee of the aftermath, as we've been still trying to go through all this. So results are still coming out of this, and that's what I'm gonna start telling you about now. But the key point was that we needed to use the gratings, or we wanted to use the gratings to get good spectral resolution, but by putting the gratings in front of the CCD, essentially what's happening is you lose a lot of resolution or sensitivity, so you have to integrate for even longer. So we actually calculated we needed 3 megaseconds of time, which is crazy for Chandra, but that's actually what they gave us. And so we had 38 observations between February and October, so it started literally, like I said, 2 weeks after the last EHT meeting, and we wanted as long as possible ones for high cadence and good windowing functions for the variability. So 14 of those observations were about a day long. So we had about 35 days of observations with Chandra in 1 year. Within 1 year, we doubled the photon count compared to the last 11 years, to give you some idea of what a difference that made. And we had, of course, a lot of flares. And so we were able, for the first time, to get high resolution spectra, so spatially and spectrally resolved accretion flow. That was the idea we were going after. We were trying to look at this iron complex and see what was going on. And then one of the key points was that we could avoid this thing called pileup, which basically means that there's a readout problem if you have brighter sources that skews your ability to know what the spectrum is. And we really wanted to know what the spectrum was for modeling, particularly of the flares, and so that was another thing we were going after. And so this is just a shot of the campaign over the year, and we assembled a large bevy of multi-wavelength observations as well, going from TEV gamma rays to radio, and you can even see that we had EHT prototype 3 station in there, but unfortunately I think Shep, we had bad weather or something. Nothing happened, unfortunately, with EHT at that time, but we did a lot with submillimeter, and I'll come back to that. This is this is sort of a blow up of the July-August period to give you some idea. Every time you see one of these lines, that's a flare from Sagittar. So we're still going through this data set, and there's a lot that I can't tell you in these few minutes, but this is fantasy. This was what we made for our observation, we made a simulation with marks of what we would have expected to see with 3 megaseconds of the spectrum. So we thought we'd resolve the iron complex. We were hoping to see some other features that would help us understand the gas diagnostics and the plasma temperature. And we'd seen this in other sources like M81, so we were sort of optimistic. And this is the reality. So we did actually find all these lines. It's really great. One of the key points, though, is that if you look here, we have a whopping helium-like iron line, basically dominating that complex, but there is no iron K-alpha to be seen. And then we also didn't even have any hydrogen-like iron, which is a bit of a surprise. So that, together with the fit and some of the other lines, gives you a really good sense of the basic properties of this accretion flow, because sure enough, it is an accretion flow. We could actually rule out this coronally active star model because we saw no fluorescent iron line. So that was one of the first reassuring results, because if we didn't have the accretion flow resolved, that would be a loss of a major constraint and kind of confuse us. But one of the other key points is that we could constrain the radial distribution of the gas, because basically if you imagine that you have M dot being captured at Bondi, so M dot Bondi, let's call it, and then you characterize it as R over the Bondi radius to the power S as the radial distribution. If S is equal to 0, that's the no outflow. What comes in and is captured is exactly what you get into the black hole. That would give you an R to the minus 3 half distribution, which would be very peaky and would give you a lot of hot, dense gas towards the black hole itself. And the fact that we don't see these this hydrogen-like iron line and just the ratios in general, we could rule this out, actually, to high statistics. So basically, we favor a value greater than 0.6, probably somewhere around 1. And what that means is that a lot of gas is being lost. Probably about 99% or more of the gas that's being captured is being lost. Now, this was not a surprise. This is a confirmation of some of our ideas that came from, for instance, Faraday rotation measurements by people like Dan Maron and Jeff Bauer and so on, that we knew the target window of gas getting down to the black hole was more like 10 to the minus 7 to 10 to the minus 9 solar masses per year, whereas the X-rays at the outer edge would tell us we had about 10 to the minus 6 captured. But a lot of stuff started to come together from this. This is some work, actually, my two PhD students, together with Chris Vergil and Jason Dexter as well. We were using the code COSMOS++, which actually had radiative terms. You could actually, it's a conservative code, and you could actually look at the effect of cooling and heating on the dynamics in the optically thin regime. And so we were exploring whether, you know, looking at this range allowed by the Faraday rotation, which accretion rate would give us the best fit to Sagittarius submillimeter bump. And in fact, we strongly favored, along with other groups, this was mentioned earlier, I think, by Marta, about 10 to the minus 9 solar masses a year, which is exactly consistent with this S to the 1 power that we would expect now based on our Chandra observations. So I think what this tells us is that we've got a pretty good sense of what's happening at the outer boundary, how the stuff is going in, how much is coming into the black hole, and now we want to understand more about the plasma physics very close to the black hole to guide our modeling. Okay, this is actually the beauty shot of the image made of the black hole's accretion flow. And the green shows you the point spread function as basically the flares are not resolved, so that's coming from the flares. And you can see this red scruff, which is basically the accretion flow around Sagittarius. And it's elongated in a sort of east-west direction. This is the galactic plane. This ellipse is not just there like to guide your eye, but that's actually the axial ratio and tilt of the clockwise stellar disk, which is what we've generally thought is the source of the gas around Sagittarius. So the fact that it lines up with the source of this gas that has a certain tilt and angular momentum is another nice reality check and sort of confirms that probably it is being fed by these stars. Now, we saw a lot of flares. We tripled the number of flares, basically from 20 to 60, or about 65 in general, in this campaign. And so this is just some nice little shots of the light curve. We see a lot of different kinds of behavior. We saw a very large one in the first weeks of observations, 140 times quiescence. And because we didn't have the issue with pileup and we had the spectral gradients, we could actually look at the light curves as a function of bands and do really good spectroscopy and start to understand something. To give you some sense, the cooling time scale at these you know, inferred magnetic fields and temperatures is very high. It's like 1,000 seconds. Whereas these bins are on the order of, you know, this is 3 times 10 to the 4, 3.2 times 10 to the 4. So basically, what you're seeing is actually the injected energy, because it would just cool away. It's a series of injecta, and it tells us something about what's happening close to the black hole and the energy source. Now, Salome, who's here and has a poster, you can ask her more about this. But we started also looking at, instead of these macroscopic dynamical simulations, we also looked at single zone models. We could start to track the particle distribution evolution, especially during the flares, to see if we can infer something about the plasma processes. And for instance, one of the big points when you think about painting simulations is that you're inserting processes like non-thermal processes, or you just insert a canned distribution like a Maxwellian or a Maxwellian plus a power law. And what Salome showed is that this is a classic Maxwellian and power law. You can often end up in regimes where you're not thermalized. And so this can have an effect on the spectrum. These are the sorts of things that you'd like to know to guide how you paint the simulations. And you can also look at how you go from quiescence into flaring. And one of the big issues is that having simultaneous spectra from submillimeter to infrared to X-ray is still a real challenge. And that's very constraining for the models. So originally, when Heino and I and other people started working on this, we were favoring a synchrotron self-Compton model for the flares in general. And then what happened was NuSTAR, I don't think I have the data here, but NuSTAR extended the Chandra out to more of a power law. And there was a hint that there was a more stable flux and flux level and slope in the infrared. And if you put that together, looking at an individual flare, this is not simultaneous, but it seemed to favor a synchrotron interpretation. But the limitation of not having simultaneous data can be overcome to some extent by having populations. And so the new thing that's happening, and we're just starting to really work through this, is that we have these population of flares, and we can look at the statistics and look at timescales and start to think about what this can mean. And we can compare the variability to the lots of work has been done both by the UCLA and the German group to characterize the variability of the infrared timescales and compare this to the X-ray and see if we can understand if it's the same process or not in a more statistical way. So for instance, comparing the different distribution functions. Now Salome's post is about this, so I'll just show you the punchline, is that the cumulative distribution function of the variability seems to be different enough that we think it's probably ruling out the simplest particle acceleration synchrotron model, which is a bit of a surprise. And so there's a lot of things that we're going to be doing with this, but just to give you a hint of the information that comes out of this. So where are we? So we basically, coming back to these overarching questions, I think we have a very good idea about the fueling from Sagittarius now. And the point is, of course, if you're making a model that you're eventually going to, you know, fit data with, or EHT data, for instance, even if you're looking at the inner regions around Sagittarius, you need to be able to connect it to the outer regions, and now we understand those boundary conditions. So your model has to make sense if you extend it backwards. We have a pretty good idea that we have some kind of lossy, radiatively inefficient accretion flow coming in, but this existence of bona fide jets is still up in the air, and I think Jeff is going to talk next about our valiant but failed attempt to look for jets during variability studies, but we ended up finding something else very interesting out, and that's how it goes. So we have a good sense of the plasma characteristics of the larger scale plasma, but also from the variability and fitting the submillimeter bump, we have pretty solid numbers that can guide our modeling as well for what's happening in the inner radii. And of course, there's this big question about particle acceleration and what role it plays in the flaring emission that we're just starting to start to tackle with this. Now, in the meantime, we haven't stopped looking at Sagittarius. G2, boon or bust, has actually, you know, been a really great object to get us to get lots of time. And so I think the secondary science, if you consider G2 the primary science, has been really amazing continuing this. And so just to give you a feel, there's a lot of multi-wavelength stuff, even involving Hubble coming in. And for instance, Spitzer got into the game. We've actually seen infrared flares with Spitzer now. And this is really great because it doesn't have the same limitations sometimes in the observing windows that the ground base has. So we need to start folding this into the picture. And we saw in 2013 the brightest flare ever, 400 times quiescence, and it's got this funky double peak, which we don't really understand. But it's so bright that we could actually do a power spectral distribution for the first time. So this is work in progress that Daryl's leading, Daryl Haggard. This is the timescale of the flare itself. This is the timescale of those peaks. Now, plus some noise is here, so I wouldn't bet any number, you know, any money on these at all as a characteristic variability, but if you think that we monitor and we might see even brighter flares, we have the possibility to look at timescales that start to probe interesting timescales for ISCOs, depending on spin or no spin, and I think that that's really cool. So we want to keep doing this. Just 2 weeks ago or so, we saw a new really bright flare that we haven't even analyzed, but we didn't have a lot of multi-wavelength coverage. So the kicker is that I want to kind of end with is that we have more observations coming up, but we desperately need good simultaneous coverage. And so there's been claims of this sort of trend that the variability goes nicely from X-ray infrared to submillimeter, but this is not well set at the moment. And you know, we really need to confirm or deny this, and we definitely need to understand how the submillimeter fits into this, especially for EHT. So as a kind of last plea to those of you who are in the audience and thinking about this, of course, we want to try to line up our observations as we're thinking about EHT prototypes, thinking about submillimeter. Let's get this all into line with Spitzer and Chandra so that we can nail this down. So my summary is basically that, you know, this X-ray visionary project has been really a great flurry of results that has taught us a lot about what's happening around Sagittarius A-star just in time to really develop these new rounds of EHT related models. I think it's going to guide these models. It helps us, and if you know, and you have to make sure that the models are consistent with what we're finding here, and that's an important takeaway point. So I said it already, we kind of understand a lot about the accretion flow and the outflows, and the flares are just an incredible wealth of data, especially when it comes to the microphysics. Now we have a sense that this is magnetically powered, but we don't know what the mechanism is. I think Elliot's going to be talking about one possibility later. But there's so much there that will help us in our attempts to paint simulations that we should be looking at. So outlook is continued observations, and I think with Sagittarius Star, we really, of all sources, have the really best chance to nail this issue now about jets and flares and try to understand the connection. I didn't have time to talk about this, but Riley has a poster on this. Sagittarius Star can actually be connected very easily to other sources. It is unique in some ways, but in many ways, dynamically, it looks just like every other low luminosity AGN or X-ray binary in the hard state, and the big difference seems to be the particle acceleration. So something in this mess of particle acceleration and flares is the key link, I think, to how Sagittarius Star connects to M87. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Questions?
You mentioned that. So you keep referring to this as an inflow, and I'm wondering if there's any hint in your spectrum of broad wings in the iron lines or any of the other lines that might really tell you whether it is in fact an inflow or a static atmosphere.
So here, I mean, I think on the scales that we're looking at, we're definitely probing. I mean, those diagnostic lines that we're looking at are on scales of the Bondi radius down to 100 Schwarzschild radii. So we're not probing regions where we would be looking at the really fast outflows. From that, we wouldn't expect to see signatures. The only signature of the outflow is the fact that we're missing mass, that we're clearly losing mass there. I think, from my point of view, the biggest evidence of outflows is in the variability. I didn't have time to show this, but we see variability moving from basically submillimeter out to the radio, and there's, you know, the difference comes in the interpretation. Some groups interpret this as a hot blob expanding adiabatically, subrelativistically. Heino and I and Jeff and others prefer a more relativistic approach, and I think that future monitoring will hopefully nail this down. But the scattering screen, combined with the fact that you're looking at very small scales, if you go to higher frequencies and get away from the scattering screen, is a kind of perverse alignment that makes it really hard to see if there's an actual jet there or an actual broad outflow. I don't know if that addresses your question, but.
Sure, addressing many questions at once, actually. So other questions? There, yeah, Andrea. Well, just a second, though. I understand you, but some people in the back may not.
I just wanted to emphasize the Spitzer results that you brought up. That was an experiment that was inspired by Eric Beckland saying we have to do this. And that Spitzer can measure Sag A star incredibly well.
It was a surprise. And
it's thanks to the pointing work that they did for exoplanets, so they understand their PSF very well and their pointing. So in the ground-based work with the AO, it's all a matter of resolution. And in fact, for the VLT, you see Sag A star 70% of the time, CAC you see it 90% of the time. With Spitzer, you see it 70% of the time with none of this breaking interference of the
night.
The sun. It's going around the sun. So it's really valuable. And in fact, understanding that X-ray to IR, you need those long time baselines.
So this is going to be key, and unfortunately, we did have some alignment with Spitzer and Chandra recently, but they didn't see a flare. And now the alignment, I think for the next, we didn't get Spitzer observations approved, and there's this big question about where the X-ray windows are going to line up, and there's some flexibility, and we're trying again. But I think that this is one of the best hopes we have to really nail this issue. And I mean, I just want to mention the only hint that we had, right, of some kind of response of the radio to the infrared was after a very large Keck flare, but then it was on scales of like 20 hours later, so we had no windowing in between. We have no idea if something else happened in the meantime.
Right, yeah. Okay.